thanks for listening and thanks for subscribing to Learning More. Today, we are talking with Todd Fisher. We're going to be talking about his mom, Debbie Reynolds, and his sister, Carrie Fisher. We learn more about these two great actresses today on Learning More. Today, we discuss Mary Frances Reynolds. She was born in El Paso, Texas on April 1st, 1932. When she turned six, her family moved to Southern California. By the time she was 16, she had a movie contract with Warner Brothers and a name change. She became Debbie Reynolds. She then moved to MGM, and she was in this film called 2 Weeks with Love. She sang a song, and it sold more than a million copies. The next big hit for her was Singin' in the Rain, where she danced alongside Fred Astaire. In 1955, she met Eddie Fisher, and just a few weeks after they met, they were engaged. Now, there's a little bit of a twist to that story that we'll hear later. In September of 1955, they were married. A year later, they had their daughter, Carrie Fisher. We all know her and love her as Princess Leia in Star Wars. Another year goes by for Debbie and Eddie, and their second child is born, Todd Fisher. Todd joins us today. Hello, Todd.
The last of the Mohicans. I'm still here.
Yes, you are.
That was one of my mom's favorite opening songs. I'm still here.
Ah, yes. I remember that song. it's coming back.
That's right. And she would do it because she had survived so many things in her life that I think people enjoyed seeing her survive. You know, she was like one of these people that had this. Well, first of all, she was a real regular person, as you just outlined in your lineage there, that, you know, she had come from Texas and, you know, didn't want to even be in show business. And so this sort of, she was really just one of the people. She was a movie star fan. She went to the movies and paid a dime. And, you know, she had her favorite stars. She never dreamed that she was going to be one day.
Right. Well, actually, let's talk about that move. Why did they move from El Paso, Texas to, you know, Burbank?
So my grandfather, this is the middle of the Depression. My grandfather works for the Southern Pacific Railroad, and they give him an opportunity to take a job for them in Burbank, California. Now, at the time, Burbank is, I won't use the word, you know, it's just the armpit of nowhere. But it was a bit of a risk to come. But California was always a desirable place. You know, California is the place you ought to be.
Right.
So they moved up the truck and they moved to Burbank. Now, and literally, like the Beverly Hillbillies, they moved in a Model T Ford and everything was hanging off the truck and they were going 20 miles an hour across the desert. Very much like the Grapes of Wrath. You know, I mean, it was the Steinbeck classic, except the Reynolds family was hauling itself across there. And my great grandmother was in the truck from the Harmon side of our family. And they all came to California. And my mother started going to school in Burbank, California, and literally finished high school there. And that's how she eventually wins the Miss Burbank contest.
Like, let's start with your mom's passion and her drive. Where do you think that came from?
Well, I know where it came from because I was programmed by the same person. You know, I didn't go to a Tony Robbins convention. We were both programmed by my grandfather individually. This is Ray Reynolds. And, you know, he taught me as a little boy something that I didn't realize he had also taught my mother. I didn't know this for 25 years. But when I was a little boy, we were painting a fence. He was painting a fence in his backyard, a white picket fence like Tom Sawyer. And I walked up to him, about 7 years old, and I said, "Hey, can I get in on that action?" And he said, "Yeah, sure. But if you're going to start painting this fence with me, you have to finish it with me." And I was like, "Hey, man, no problem whatsoever. Let's roll with this." So he gives me the brush. We start painting. An hour later, I walk back over to him and I kind of hand him back the brush. And I said, I've had enough. And he says, "What?" I said, "Well, I can't do anymore." He says, "You what?" I said, "I can't do anymore." He says, "There is no word in this family's vocabulary, can't. That's not in our vocabulary." He's talking to a seven-year-old.
Right.
He's down on his knees, so he's eye to eye with me. He was very intense. And I was like, okay. And believe me, he was a little intimidating. He was a very sweet man, but he was, you know, he was the patriarch of the family, and he was like very intense. And you're like, you bought into it. So I didn't realize that he had done that to my mother many, many years prior. And that is what led up to my mother being able to withstand Gene Kelly trying to kind of get her to quit. I mean, in the middle of early days of Singin' in the Rain, he didn't want my mother at all. And he was, you know, really trying to prove his point that she wasn't up to it. And her feet were bleeding, and she's under this little piano on the soundstage, and this person leans down, and she's crying under the table, and he leans down and says, "What's going on down there?" And she looks up, and it's Fred Astaire. And he reaches out his hand to her, and he says, "Come with me." And he takes her down the road, down the MGM streets to a private soundstage where he rehearsed with Pandro Bergman and rehearsed and choreographed all of his great numbers. And he sat her down, and she watched him work really hard and beat himself to death. No one knew that it took weeks of countless hours to make those numbers perfect. No one knew. She didn't know. And then she thought, wow, if it's good enough, if that's how hard it is for Fred Astaire, I guess I understand why it's hard for me. But also echoing in the back of her mind is there's no word can't in our vocabulary.
Right.
So those two factors between Ray Reynolds and Fred Astaire, that's pretty wide apart there. That is what gave my mother her drive in life in many ways. Now, she also had tremendous faith. She was a Christian and a person of faith. And so she knew she wasn't alone in the world. And you know, so her faith was important to her as well. But these are very tangible, actionable things that she lived by.
And she was just 19 during Singing in the Rain,
that's
right?
That's right. That is.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's easy time to say I've had enough, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think of the amount of things that I quit when I was 19, you know, just from a little struggle. And she just went on, powered through. And she was even in her bed for a couple of days after one of those scenes because it was so tough, right?
It's not that she couldn't handle the work. I mean, at 19, we were all pretty tough. And she was no exception. She was a tough girl anyway. She was a tomboy. She had her uncles and her brother. You know, she grew up with them. She was one girl amongst many boys. And so she was a very, very quite capable to stand up to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, you ask yourself in this world, we hear a lot about, you know, the Harvey Weinsteins of the world and people like that. And like, you know, you can imagine that people tried to pull that with my mom.
Right.
You know, but also imagine that she bit back.
Oh, yeah. I would imagine that Carrie would bite back as well.
Yeah, so Carrie actually had a direct story with Harvey Weinstein where, you know, he had inappropriately talked to her or tried to touch her in some inappropriate way. You know, I can't say what she said precisely, but she told him to take his little, you know what, and head to the other room. So she really slammed the guy. And this also happened to a friend of hers, and she found out about it. And so she sent Harvey a dead fish in the mail. Like a Sicilian message, a large sea bass.
Wow.
You know, but the truth is both my mother and Carrie were also just tough broads. You know, they're quite capable of standing up for themselves. Not everybody is, but they certainly were. And my mother was, you know, infamous for being able to handle herself. I mean, you know, and of course, Carrie, in my opinion, was kind of a level beyond that. She had a lightsaber to boot, you know, so.
Right, exactly. Hey, you know, one of the things that I've often heard, you know, Carrie would have said something about her childhood, maybe not having a happy childhood. Now, you say that you had a happy childhood. What's the story there?
Well, I mean, the problem with Carrie's story, my mother used to joke about it all the time, but it's true. She was like, Carrie would say, "I didn't have a happy childhood." And my mother would say, "Yes, you did. I have films." and she had like, we have hundreds of hours of home movies, you know, where Carrie is just raucousing around with me. And we have elephants in the backyard and these huge parties and all the celebrities are there and all of our friends are there with elaborate cakes and we've rented out theme parks. I mean, it's surreal. So the idea that you had an unhappy childhood when you look at the world we grew up in is incredibly absurd. And I used to say to Carrie, you could get away with it maybe if she didn't have the movies and I wasn't here. The fact is, I was there every minute. I lived it.
So, yeah, exactly.
So, by the way, she didn't know about this unhappy childhood until she went into therapy and some therapist tried to point out that, you know, all of your problems, you know, are from your parents and Freudian other issues. And, you know, as therapy evolved over the decades, you know, we stopped blaming our parents and took some personal responsibility, and maybe our childhood was actually not that bad after all.
You know, you mentioned the parties, and okay, so you know, your mom, Hollywood legend, right? And you're growing up around her. She's just mom, so it's normal for you. But I'm assuming, you know, but as a kid, you're next to all these other legends. I mean, you probably had Frank Sinatra hanging out of your house.
We had everybody. I mean, at one time or another, you know, and so we, and that was our version of normal, right?
You right. Know,
it's not
right.
as though that wasn't, that was normal. But on the other hand, like in hindsight, you know, or at different times, you could look back at one of these parties and go, wow, I just met Charlie Chaplin and Norman Rockwell and right. you know, Betty Davis. I can remember oh, like Edward God. G. Robinson dancing with my mother at a party and Jimmy Stewart and Gary Cooper. I mean, it's like everybody mm-hmm. you could think of was at our yeah. house at one time or another. So that's a little surreal, but it was our version of normal. I mean, I like one of the great people that used to come to our parties was James Garner. And what I remember about that is that he didn't like the parties that much. So he'd come in my room and play slot cards with me and my friends.
So, that's awesome.
And in my book, I write about Betty Davis being in my bathroom and me walking in on her in my bathroom and her having a full conversation with me while she's sitting on the John. Yeah, now that's pretty freaking surreal.
That is.
And, oh, wow. Now that one I even remember being intimidated by, and it took a lot to intimidate me, you know.
It seems like in some of the documentaries and whatnot that I've watched about your mom, you know, she wanted to be a mom. I mean, she had this job, but she wanted to be a mom. She brought you guys on the set and, you know, hung out with you there. And, you know, she was just trying to be just, well, I guess, like an old school Texas mom.
Well, that's true. And in the end, she was asked a question, what was the thing you were most proud of? And it was her children and her mm-hmm. raising us the way that she did. She did such an amazing job of keeping that balance. But you're right. She took us everywhere. But it wasn't like the nanny thing, although we had nannies around at times. But, I mean, she was hands-on. And, you know, she didn't bypass the responsibility and leave us home. And, you know, we traveled the world with her and we're on sets all over the world and all over the country and hung out at the studio with her. And you know, she was a hands-on mother. And it was very unusual because I had a lot of other friends in similar situations and their mother, you know, sort of, you know, let the nanny handle things or right. stayed home a lot. So I knew I was privileged in that regard.
Oh, yeah. You know, or you read about everybody.
Right, you know the story. I don't even name the names, yeah. but I mean, there were a lot yeah. of kids that you haven't read books about, you know, that got screwed up, you know, because they didn't really have any parents. You know, they were raised right. by the housekeepers. You know, I mean, that's just not happening. My mother was very hands-on, very conscientious. She was very fixated on making sure we weren't spoiled. Now, that's not to say we didn't have everything. We had a ton of stuff, but she made a distinction about being spoiled. She said, I know a lot of people that have very little that are spoiled. She says, the difference is if you appreciate what you have, then you're not spoiled. Mm. But when you don't appreciate what you have, now you're spoiled. And it's an interesting thing to teach children. Those are the life lessons that, you know, we grew up around. I mean, you got to remember, my mother was grooming Carrie as a little Beverly Hills princess long before George Lucas ever had the idea that he was looking for a Princess Leia. And so for my whole life, my mother's grooming Carrie a certain way. And everything you know about Carrie is part of the way my mother groomed her and raised her. By the time she walks into this little audition room and George Lucas is there and has her read the script, and she says, I'd recognize your foul stench anywhere. And she's got that attitude in Darth Vader's face. And immediately George Lucas is like, there it is. There's the princess. What he didn't know is that, you know, that had been going on and had been worked on and groomed by my mother, you know, for a decade.
Yeah. And she was just 19 when she got that role, right?
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? My mother.
Yeah. Both of them at 19 with their big roles.
Well, it's not just the big roles. Here's an interesting little mirrored effect. You know, the greatest musical arguably ever made is Singing in the Rain. My mother stars in that at 19. The greatest science fiction film ever made is the original Star Wars film.
Right.
Where he stars at that at 19. That's an interesting little mirroring there.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to think, if anybody is going to think a musical, they're going to think Singing in the Rain. If anybody's going to think science fiction, it's that, you know, Star Wars.
That's right.
I mean, so, yeah, I mean, that's pretty amazing.
There's not other great films. It's just to say that those are pretty influential, and
totally
could be argued that they're the best in their respective areas.
Oh yeah, definitely. I don't even think it's worth an argument. I think it's truth.
It depends who you're talking to. A lot of film historians, I'm sure you could bring up some great other film, and I'm a bit of a film buff myself, but I know the things that influenced George, and so you could say 2001. Carrie was being interviewed in London one time, back when we were working on the first Star Wars film, and they asked her, they said, "What's your favorite science fiction film?" And literally she froze, and you could see her look over the guy's shoulder to me, and I'm mouthing the words 2001, because it's the only science fiction film that she, we weren't big science fiction fans. Right.
So
it wasn't like she just froze. She couldn't think of anything at the moment.
Right.
She could have said War of the Worlds. You could have said Fantastic Planet. You could have said a lot of stuff, but she just literally just froze. Oh, you heard the sound, the blaster sound in the background. That's Archie.
Yeah, that's Carrie's parrot in the background, right?
That's right. So Archie has been with me for about 30 years, but he belonged to Carrie for about a decade and then was given to me about 20 years ago. So he was brought up on laser blaster sound. So occasionally, if you hear that sound in the background, you know it's not me watching a movie. It's just the bird.
That's funny. Does the parrot talk?
Oh, yes. In fact, he even talks in Carrie's voice. He says, "Hello, dear." See, Carrie used to do a mocking of my mother. My mother used to call us up on the phone, and she'd say, "Hello, dear, this is your mother." And we'd be like, yeah, like we don't know. But she kind of talked like that sometimes when she was being formal. "Hello, dear, dear, Lillian and I would love to come over, you know." It was like an old Hollywood dialect, you know, and Carrie and I used to make fun of her when she would do that. So the inside joke that she teaches the bird is, "Hello, dear." So, but it knows a lot of other words.
That's funny.
And he does it perfectly in her voice, which can be a little eerie at times.
That's so cool. It's a piece of Carrie and a piece of your mom all rolled into one bird. The stories that bird can tell, huh?
Yeah. Well, our whole life is about storytelling. My mother was a master storyteller and handed that down to Carrie and I. And of course, Carrie wrote tons of stories as well. But we all love storytelling. I just think that is what this business is all about. I'm not interested in rehashing, Spider-Man 12. I mean, I think it's fine for those people that love that type of thing, but I just think there's millions of great stories that have been untold, that don't get told because we're all fixated on the next Batman series, but it's a shame because, we live in a world with every day unfolding more and more inspirational, great stories. And so to me, my mother and sister's story was very inspirational. And that is why I wrote the book, My Girls, about them and how they moved through life and accomplished a lot of the things that they accomplished. And I had kind of a front row seat to that show.
Right. Well, and also in Bright Lights, the documentary.
Yes. Well, I was one of the producers on that film, and that was actually Carrie's idea. She was concerned that my mother was getting old and frail and wasn't sure how much longer we were going to have her. And so she was like, "Let's do like a legacy piece on my mom." And I said, "Oh, that's never going to go over. She's never going to want to do that." Mm-hmm. So you got to come up with a better angle to get her to do it. So the angle became more of the story about the family and her and Carrie, and she bought off on that notion that it could be, really we were sneaking around the idea of doing a legacy piece on her, but my mother was very conscientious about not wanting to blow her own horn ever. It was always, in fact, it used to annoy me at times when we were doing the museum, here in Vegas, we had the Hollywood Museum, and I put out a bunch of Debbie costumes with hundreds of other costumes. And my mother showed up at one point and said, "Oh, there's too many Debbie costumes." I said, "So what do you want me to get rid of? Singing in the Rain?" I have two Singing in the Rain costumes. Should I get rid of Good Morning as opposed to, what are we talking about here? If it was anybody other star and her name wasn't there, she'd be fine with it.
Right.
But she was conscientious. There was too many Debbie costumes. By the way, I took them down for like 2 weeks and then I put them back up again. Because I knew the people would want to see it.
Totally. Like, if you're gonna go, you got to see that.
Well, and it's her collection. It's not about her, but it is indirectly, and people want to see her as much as they do all these other people, but she never saw herself as important as a lot of these other stars. I think it would have been rather interesting and gratifying for her when she did get to watch what happened when she passed. I mean, the outpouring from her fans was unbelievable. And it was Carrie's fans and her fans. It was just unbelievable. The connection that she had with her fans became very apparent. And all of a sudden, nobody could deny her importance. And not even her. Now, she wasn't here to complain about it. But I was gratified at any rate.
All right. I have got so many more topics to talk to you about. So we're going to take a short break here. But when we come back, I want to find out about your parents' meeting. I want to find out a little bit more about Carrie and your final moments with your mom and with Carrie. We'll talk about that when we come back. Thanks for listening, and thank you for subscribing to Learning More. I'm Russ, and today I am joined by Todd Fisher. We've been talking about his mom, Debbie Reynolds, his sister, Carrie Fisher, and we all know what happened in 2016. Just after Christmas, Carrie Fisher passed away. The very next day, Debbie Reynolds passed away. Now, a lot of people say that Debbie died of a broken heart, but Todd, you justifiably, I feel, disagree with that. You were there. What happened?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, it's not like I wanted to contradict that point of view, but it's just not true or nor accurate. It was a bunch of these, you know, PhD pundits on the news shows trying to explain, you know, what had happened to Debbie when they have absolutely no information whatsoever about the reality of what happened. But I was right there. I mean, I was literally with her for her last words. And the last words were, "I need to be with Carrie." Now, I didn't know what she was talking about at that moment. You know, you just think they're words. I didn't realize she literally meant she was going to go be with Carrie. But there was no heartbreak or tears. It was literally a intentional departure. You know, philosophically, she knew. First of all, in my book, I write about me being brought into this world. My mother chased my father down. She knew the marriage wasn't going along that well, but she didn't want Carrie to be an only child. She didn't want her to be alone. Mm-hmm. She literally ran my father down in Europe and gave him a couple of beers, and she got pregnant. She was with her best friend, and she went back to the room after sleeping with him one time, and she said to her best friend, "Okay, we can go home now." And it was like, "Debbie, that's not how it works. I mean, you don't, you know." She goes, "No, I know I'm pregnant. We can go home." And you know, she's like, that can't be. We're going home." Goes home, and here I am talking to you right now. So obviously, she had a pretty good sense of this. But what it was all about was she wanted Carrie to have a companion. I was the companion. Now, when I couldn't follow Carrie, she had just left the earth. My mother knew that, but she, in her mind, could and did. And so there's a certain amount of sadness and grief that hits you about that. But when I realized what had happened and she had willed herself off the earth to be with Carrie, it became more magical opposed to something sad. Right. And that I had to share because I knew that Debbie's fans would want to understand what had happened and why. Right. It wasn't about, "Oh, I'm so sad I died of grief." Yeah. It just didn't happen. I was with her from front to back. I didn't leave her for a 24-hour period there after the hospital with Carrie. And it was not about that. So it's kind of magical and beautiful.
Yeah, it is. I mean, to hear that, you know, because it was so depressing to hear this news. I mean, I'm telling you this, but I mean, you know, it's like for everybody, you know, everybody that was a fan of either one of them, we, you know, just, it was sadness everywhere. And it's an uplifting story in an odd way.
Well, I think people were shocked that it could even be. Like, it's surreal. Yeah. And you're like, "What? How could this be?" Yeah. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, the fact that Carrie died the way she died was already sort of inexplicable, and the timing of that is odd. I made a comment recently where I said, you know, the truth is we were lucky to have Carrie that long, given her propensity for mental illness and her drug issues. And, you know, she lived in the fast lane. That's all there is to it. And, mm-hmm. and so that we had her all those years was miraculous. And my mother at the end, when she was in a coma, my mother prior to her actually passing said, could we just have a little more time, like in an outwardly spoken prayer. She just wanted a little more time. She always just wanted a little more time. And we got it for 60 years. You know, it was a miracle that she lived past the teenage years and then her 20s. And there was a lot of close calls. Mm-hmm. And later in life, if it wasn't for her daughter, Billy, and the responsibility of being a mother, I think she maybe would have left us even sooner. You know, I mean, there was no question that she held herself to some accountability because of her daughter. We all do. Yeah. You know, kids make you be responsible.
Mm-hmm.
Well, or they don't, in which case you're a crappy
parent. You're right. what about your last moments with Carrie?
Well, so Carrie and I had the moment that's relevant is she was going to come home for her birthday, but she couldn't make it because they were filming Star Wars. And then she came home like a few weeks later and we had this big birthday party. My mother was adamant that we had to have the biggest blowout party of all time. So we literally went crazy. I mean, we had so much equipment. It was the wildest party we had ever thrown, the most elaborate. We had to have generators brought in. I mean, it was like, you know, it was like crazy, this party.
Yeah.
And you know what? At first, Carrie wasn't that into it. And then when she saw everything was happening, she was like, yeah, this is fantastic. So that party went on and it went on and on and on. And then it was like the end of the party comes and everybody's leaving. And finally, Carrie and I are alone in her den. And we have this really beautiful moment where we were like, you know, it's just going to be you and me. You know, we need to go back to our days where we traveled together. And, you know, we need to go back to that because we're not going to have her that much longer. It's more than obvious. We almost lost her the year before, you know, she had a stroke and we almost lost my mom. And then she came back and, you know, we just had to recognize that it wasn't going to be, it was a finite amount of time we were going to have our mother. And she was like reaching out like, hey, you know, it's you and me, kid. And I was like, hey, I am in, you know, just like old times. That's why we're here. And we just had this beautiful moment and we were both in tears and it was a great moment. And a few days later, she left and went back to Europe, to England, to mm-hmm. work on the film. And, you know, she never came home. I mean, she did come home, but she had had a stroke on the plane. And my last moments with her, you know, was just one-sided. It was me talking in her ear in the hospital. And I tried to encourage her to stick around, you know, and I reminded her of those words that she spoke. But there was no way, you know, that she could do it physically. She just, you know, too much had happened to her. The damage on the plane, you know, apparently, you know, was too much. You combine that with the already pre-existing conditions that she had. She wasn't in the greatest health. I mean, my sister literally drank a six-pack of Coke a day every day of her life. And she was an intermittent smoker, even though she didn't fully admit it. And then you couple that in with the freaking pills that the doctors gave her. My God, I mean, it was endless amounts of different medications and psychotropic drugs. And, you know, so she took her body took a lot of abuse. You know, genetically, Carrie and I were almost identical. I mean, our hair color, our eye color, you know, our physique, everything about us, skin tone, everything was very similar. Because we were very obviously the same parents, but also very, you know, only a year apart, et cetera. So genetically, we were very similar. And a lot of times we sort of felt things the same, like twins do. You know, we had sort of these interesting little sort of connections. And and so I always, you know, I always thought, wow, I don't know how you're surviving all of this. I mean, I watched her go through overdoses and things and I was like, this is so hard on your body. And, you know, I've never had these issues. So nobody understands, trust me, what it's like to walk in those shoes unless you actually walk in those shoes, which I never have. I never judged her. And all the people that judged my sister, I used to say, you know what? You don't know. You don't have these issues. You don't know what another man's burden is. you know? And so, and then like when the press called me after she died, you know, sometime later, they snuck the toxicology report out of the hospital, you know, against everybody's wishes. Right. And, you know, they called me and said, well, what do you think about this report about drugs being in Carrie's system? I'm like, what? Like, who cares? Well, what do you think? I don't think anything. I mean, what? That's news? Oh, there's drugs in Carrie's system. Shocking. Oh, well, there's some news. Let's send out the world. You know, I mean, it's like, I said, did you read any of her books? She outed herself in the last 30 years. I mean, come on.
Clearly, they didn't wishful drinking.
Let's go back to Postcards from the Edge. You know, it's three decades ago. You know, it's or 4 decades. It's like, you know, that was what was brilliant about Carrie is she was willing to put herself out there. She was willing to, as she used to say, our family wears its underwear on the outside of its clothes. And what she meant by that is there's like nothing private in this family because we are owned by our fan base. So everything is shared and you have to just own that. And she was okay with it. And she did. She shared everything with her fans. And that's partly what a lot of those books were about. And when she outed herself for mental illness, I mean, that's heroic stuff.
She was, I think, way more heroic than her Princess Leia character.
Well, they certainly are one and the same, but you're right, because Princess Leia didn't have the ailments that Carrie had in real life.
Right.
So the idea that you could be Princess Leia while you have a mental illness and write 6 books and rewrite 50 scripts and act in 50 movies and still be Princess Leia.
Right.
I mean, that's pretty friggin' remarkable.
That is.
So she's in many ways more heroic than my mother. People always, you know, knew my mother to be pretty heroic because of the way she survived divorce and a lot of things and public humiliation and by my father. And, you know, people always admired her for the way she handled herself in life like that. And that was an admirable thing. But Carrie was more heroic in the sense that she had to do it all while having a mental illness.
Right.
That is a remarkable accomplishment and inspirational thing for others to see. That's what's so great about it is I cannot tell you how many literally thousands of people have written me or come up to me and told me how important it is to them that they could see, oh, if she could survive this and do all of this, and if she could take the shame away from mental illness and make it okay for us to have this disorder, I could live without that burden. I mean, that's a huge thing. People are crushed by shame.
Yeah.
And she made it okay and removed the shame. That is a miracle.
Well, you know, when you watch Wishful Drinking, which I just did again the other night, it's a one-person show that Carrie put together.
Absolutely.
And it is amazing. It is a must-watch, especially when talking about the family tree.
Yeah, it's rather splintered.
Yeah. Okay, well, that family tree started when your parents met. Now, I've heard the story that, you know, they met on a movie set a couple weeks later. They get married. They're America's sweetheart. But there's more to that story, right?
Yeah, well, so it's actually reading my father's book, you get one story. Reading my mother's book, you get another story. But then there's another story, which comes from my father's best friend, who's long since passed away. But I spoke to him about this. His name was Bernie Rich. And they were in the Korean War together. And my father was part of the he was an enlisted man, but he was also an entertainer in the Korean War. And he was entertaining the troops, as my mother was also. She had come from the States as part of Operation Entertainment to entertain the troops. And so she's on stage and he's standing in the wings looking out and he's standing next to his friend. They're both privates. And he says to Bernie Rich, he says, I'm going to get that girl. And he said, what do you mean? He says, I'm going to marry that girl. And Bernie was like, yeah, right. Well, segue forward, you know, the war has to end. So like some months go by before he's back in the States and they're back together. And then the Hollywood romance begins and he turns on the charm. So the reality is that Eddie Fisher was actually stalking my mother. And so that's the truth. I mean, he was literally obsessed with her and he was going to, you know, we use the term conquest. You know, he was going to conquer her. And he did, because he had charm like you cannot believe. Believe me, a lot of people don't understand the Eddie Fisher thing, but if you understand, look at the women that he landed and tell me he didn't have something magic. You don't land Debbie Reynolds, Elizabeth Taylor, Connie Stevens. Look at the and by there's right. others that he landed that he didn't marry. You don't land these women unless you have something going on. So he had this boy charm, you know, that was pretty. And my mother's no fool. You know, she's not like she didn't just fall out of bed. Yeah, you know, they were both naive and in their 20s, and it was young love and all of that, you know. And so, look, when that marriage fell apart, too, the other thing that I like to look at is, and there's a different side. So we all know the big story where my dad leaves. Leaves my mother for Elizabeth Taylor after Mike Todd dies. Now, I was named after Mike Todd. He was my dad's best friend. So it's kind of natural that my mother and father would have been consoling Liz. And as Carrie likes to say, you know, my father moved from her side gradually around to her front. And, you know, because he's, and that is true exactly what happened. But if you see the pictures of Elizabeth Taylor at this time, I encourage you to see the pictures of Elizabeth Taylor at this time. I mean, she is stunning. And I'm not condoning his behavior on any level, except you can understand how mesmerizing that was. I mean, he literally was blinded by this beautiful, charming lady who had her own magic. She really did. I mean, she was an amazing, charming person in her own right. Yeah. My mother was impish and beautiful and so many wonderful things, but she was also a good girl, and Liz was far from that.
You know, I couldn't help but noticing every time you mentioned Liz, Archie's whistling. So even Archie agrees with you.
Yeah, see what I'm saying? All guys react the same way. I have a picture of Liz from this time that I have in my studio that's blown up huge. And it's a picture from right at the time that this is all going on when my dad left. And many people have stood with me and they've said, are you pissed off about what happened with your dad? And I point to that picture and I say, you see that girl right there? And they all go, yes. I say, can you relate? And they say, well, I guess so. I said, be honest. Let's be honest for a minute, okay? Can you understand what happened? You know what I mean? It's like, look, he got his ass kicked for what he did. Okay. I mean, he lost his Coca-Cola contracts. He got booted by the recording companies. He lost everything.
Right. Well, she had some kickbacks too from that, right?
You got to admire one thing. I mean, you know, like he did put it, you know, he put it all out there. I mean, you know, that is some, it's crazy. But yeah. It's admirable too. I mean, he literally threw it all out there for love, so to speak.
Right. Hey, so I've got to ask because, you know, the Star Wars geeks out there are going to force me to ask, and, you know, myself included. Were you satisfied with the way that Star Wars handled the character's death?
Well, you know, it's obviously there's a duality to my issue there. You know, you're watching your sister die. You're also watching the character die. Now, I have an issue with the idea or the necessity to dispose of these characters. I mean, you know, to me, those original characters are the heart of the story. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about the droids. I'm talking about Yoda. I'm talking about Harrison and Mark and Carrie. I mean, that's to me, it's the heart of the whole story.
Yeah.
And so the idea that there's some necessity to dispose of it, I just don't get it.
Right.
It's like in a soap opera, they used to do this all the time. And then they would realize what a mistake it was. The fans would be upset and they'd have to figure out some way to bring these people back from the dead.
Right.
You know, why not? Why bother? You know, I mean, I'm not a big fan of the killing off of those characters. They will always be inseparable from the storyline. You will never be able to separate those characters, Mark and Carrie and Harrison, from that storyline. And all the new characters, I'm not saying they don't have merit. I'm just saying you're never going to be able to separate those things.
Yeah. Those movies did not have the magic of the first set of movies and the second set, really. I mean, the second set was decent, but the first set was just so good.
Now to give J.J. Abrams some credit, I mean, what J.J. did with the last film with Carrie in it was outstanding, magical. And if it wasn't for him, Carrie wouldn't have been in the movie at all, hardly, if at all. So, but it took someone like him to champion it, someone that had his clout. I'm just a big mouth or John the Baptist crying in the wilderness. You know, and I am outspoken and I don't mind. But I try to, and I look, you know, I'm Carrie's brother. I have an opinion. Is it relevant? Well, either it is or it isn't. You don't have, you could take it as such. You know, I wasn't, it's like they were pissed off a lot of the things that I had said. Like they were annoyed with me, like I could be some impartial person to all of this.
Right.
Oh, you have to think more like a corporate person.
Yeah, right.
No, I'm just Carrie's brother, and this is the way I think.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, so with your family, you're spanning fans throughout my family. Because so I told my son that I was going to be talking to, you know, Carrie Fisher's, you know, Princess Leia's brother. And he said, Luke? And I'm like, no,
exactly.
Not exactly.
No. Listen, I've had people walk up to me. I've been introduced before, like a kid will walk up to me and someone will say, hey, you know, this is Princess Leia's brother. And they'll say, oh, so you're Luke Skywalker. And I'll be like, not exactly.
Right.
I said, I am sort of related to Luke because of Carrie, but I think we might have different parents.
Right.
You'll see a one mother by a different mother. Is that how that works?
Yeah, exactly. And then I told my mom, and she, you know, so I said, oh, I'm going to talk to, and instead of saying, you know, Carrie Fisher's brother, I said, I'm going to talk with Debbie Reynolds' son. And she's, oh, Todd? She knew right away.
Yeah. So the Debbie fans are an interesting group, you know, because they've known her forever. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, there's decades. Yeah. But you know what's cool about my mother is that she spanned 7 decades of fans. Yeah. Because she did the Halloween Town stuff, there were a lot of little kids that know her as Aunt Aggie, and they would walk up to her in the airport and say, Aunt Aggie, Aunt Aggie. And the parents are like, no, that's Debbie Reynolds. They go, no, it's Aunt Aggie. You know, and you know, my mother was so okay with that, the idea that another generation embraced her, another generation of fans embraced her.
Yeah,
that's a beautiful thing. I mean, how many people in their career can say I spanned 7 decades of fans? I touched 7 decades of fans.
I find it fascinating, and this is, you know, kind of an unplanned question here. So you did some Vegas performing. You're playing a guitar on stage, things like that. You did not really enjoy being in front of the camera. You like the behind the camera, and just listening to this interview today, I feel like in many ways you were kind of behind the scenes helping out and doing things to make all of that magic that they were doing happen as well. Cause you were helping out Carrie with the struggles that she was going through, helping out your mom. It's kind of an interesting take on, you know, you being,
well,
behind the scenes.
I have a way of explaining it. I considered myself the designated driver.
That's perfect.
Because at one time or another, my mother was off the rails. Carrie goes off the rails. You know, so I spent a lot of time trying to keep them on the rails. I tell you, I was never attracted. I did some acting in my time. I did some television and film stuff. And I'm not saying I don't like it. It's fun. But I just never saw it as something that I wanted to be my career, my job. I much preferred orchestrating other things from behind the scenes and seeing projects born, you know, from paper to film or paper to digital. You know, I just enjoyed the process of seeing things created from nothing. An actor also does that, but it's just not as broad. And I liked the process too much. When I was a little boy, my mother had a television special called The Sound of Children. It's actually the first time Carrie appears on television and I in acting roles. And Carrie loved it. And we were working on the Disney back lot. And when I arrived on the set, all these people that I had grown up around, crew members and camera people, they were all out working. And I immediately wanted to go out and hang out with them. But as I was walking towards them, I was grabbed and moved into a trailer with all the other actors, you know, where we were proceeded to have class and then make sure our lines and then do makeup and hair and wardrobe. And all I could do was look out the window and see where all the magic was happening.
Right.
The wranglers were out there with the horses and the wagons and the camera guys with the lights and all of the props and all this. And I'm looking out at that window and I'm sitting, and I'm like, what am I doing in here?
Right.
And I had an epiphany. You know, I was a Cub Scout, by the way. I was playing a Cub Scout, but I was actually a Cub Scout. So pre-Boy Scout, like 10 years old. You know, and it was like an epiphany, like, wow, this is just not where I want to be. I'm not saying other people don't enjoy that, hanging out in the dressing room, waiting to go out there, and everybody else does all the technical stuff. But I thought, no, man, the magic is out there. That's the magic I want to be involved with.
Hey, so I'll mention your books one more time, or your book one more time. My Girls, A Lifetime with Carrie and Debbie. Also, the Bright Lights starring Carrie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's on HBO On Demand. Yeah.
Todd, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure. It's been great chatting with you. You're very tuned into the subject matter.
Thank you.
I guess everybody was shocked that you weren't prepared. That you said this, you had one question that wasn't pre-prepared.
Yeah, I like to, I like to prep.
No, you had it down. You truly, well, I could tell you're also a big Star Wars fan. So that's something we all have in common.
Yeah, definitely. So thank you, Todd, so much for joining me. And thank you for listening and subscribing to Learning More. We'd love it if you could tell your friends about the show and share it on your social media. We've got some great shows coming up that you're definitely going to want to hang in there for. Yeah, the Olympic ruins. We're going to be talking about that. The modern Olympic ruins. It seems like nobody wants to host the games anymore. We're going to learn more about that. We're also going to be learning more about narcissism. We're going to learn more about ghosts. We got all kinds of cool shows coming up. So be sure to subscribe. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.